Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
This is your host, Greg, from the Through the Wind Door Editing Minds. This episode is going to be a little bit stitched together in a way that hasn't happened since the early days. It's a combination of the fact that our original Skype conversation got interrupted, and the fact that we ended up not having enough time to finish our topic list, so I may bring in some extra content from our later Skype call to even out the runtime. One way or another, we'll make sure to make this as exciting a show as ever. Brief warning, the subject of Frau's rape may come up in conversation, as we use it to reflect on other events during the chapters we are covering over the next few episodes. It's not likely to take up as much space as the last episode, but it will come up. With that, on with the show. We return to Miguel, and...
Yay!
That was exactly the sound effect I was going for.
There's a sound clip somewhere, and I forget where it's from exactly, but maybe I can find it.
I'm inclined to believe it's the Monty Python and the Holy Grail, just the, and there was much rejoicing.
that may well be it. Yeah, that's the
default. That laugh is needed.
Yeah, exactly. Miguel and his perspective ground us in a different way to everything that has happened. When chapter 16 begins, Rao has lost all track of time, because the very first word that she says is that I do not know if it is yesterday or today. Their extended travel in this unfamiliar place in captivity, and with the ongoing brutal suppression of keeping them in line, has made it impossible for their normal understanding of time to serve them well in terms of trying to figure out just how long they have been down there. It's a form of hell or limbo for them. Whereas with Miguel, who has understanding of things like calendars and the passage of time, in terms of like, oh, it's been weeks, it's been this amount of time. He can't keep an exact count because he worries that if he leaves any mnemonic around to help him keep track, that it will be found and they'll realize that he's more than a simple pet. Though to be honest, we do need to take into account that he is also exempt from the same amount of stress that the captives are under. His situation possibly allows touchstones that allow him to keep track of the passage of time, but he also isn't exposed to trauma designed to break his will, something that can happen as a result of things like solitary confinement or even non-physical torture in the modern world. At the very least, he understands that enough time has passed that helps us get a better sense of the world as he perceives it, and therefore the reality of how much time it has taken them to get from point A to point B. Like, in point of fact, I think back when I originally read this story, I wasn't entirely certain until they said that they were on the sea rather than, say, on a really large river or something like that, or even just traveling along the coast. Although, I suppose if they were traveling along the coast, that Harao or somebody else might have pointed that out.
Not to mention that something like the upcoming Widow of the Waves would likely only exist in the deep sea that could contain something of her mass.
So as far as Miguel is concerned, he quickly acclimates himself to his situation, as he has had to do in many times past, where, you know, he had to be constantly on the move with his father and figure out, okay, this is what's going on here. What do we need in order to survive and everything like that? It's just in this particular case, he can't communicate with anybody else, or he can't communicate with anybody else and have them be friendly at this point. So we see a lot of his internal thinking and how he puts to use the skills that he learned along the way of being with his father, and in some cases chose never to use again because they felt like sins or criminal acts that he could not forgive himself before if he continued on this way. But he realizes that the situation has changed, and so therefore uses all the tools in his toolbox in order to become more prepared for what comes next.
Something I had not considered before now, that it is a noteworthy detail that Miguel, despite killing the lion being the thing he regrets more than anything else he's done in his life, and how much that haunts him, he does not say the same thing that he said when previously he was a part of what his father had done to the family that he really loved and valued. In that moment, he vowed, "I will not do this again, Father." He does not make that promise after killing the lion. And I think that it's possible that some part of him knows that whether or not he chooses not to do this again, that will not stop the fact that he has done this. That is something that the text makes quite apparent, is that in contrast to that moment I've just talked about, or that one line from his chapters where he says, "My crimes are small, my sins forgivable," there is probably, up till now, Miguel has worked with this assumption that no matter what he did, he would regret it, but he could maybe make amends for it, to maybe write over the harm he had done by striving to be better. And I think this is the moment where he categorically acknowledges that there are some things that no matter what you do after, you will never be able to undo what you did, what you have done. And I think that's one of the significant turning points at this moment.
Well, it's why it's his lowest point.
Exactly.
You're right that he doesn't have a moment where he says, "I can't ever do that again." But he does have that internal thought process prior to the initial fatal act, where he ponders his ability to, say, use the poison claws on the captain or on Mohawk, and very much feeling like he wants to do this because he wants to punish them for what they have done. When he finally kills just a random guard or sailor and experiences what that's like for him to have to go through, see the terror and the pain that's overcoming them, having to look into their eyes as their life departs them, he says, "Could I do this now to these other villains that I hate? I'm not sure if I can anymore." And it has nothing to do with sin. It has to do with the emotional experience of having done so.
Yeah. And can he do it after knowing what the action entails?
Yeah. Can he steel himself enough to commit an ultimately fatal, violent act again? Even if they deserve it more.
Yeah. Exactly. I think it's brilliant that this happens with a random unnamed guard. If Miguel had actually sort of mustered up and killed Beatrix and had this same sort of moment of intense trauma from just the experience of taking a life, that would also be one thing. But I think that this is an action that not only Miguel in the lead up to it takes for granted, but the audience somewhat takes for granted. Your mileage may vary, but It's more than likely that you've either watched a film where the main character is sneaking around and has to dispatch with a random goon, or you've played a game like an Assassin's Creed or a Metal Gear Solid where you are trying to get from point A to point B and there's unnamed, faceless mooks around, and you decide, okay, let's just sort of take this guy out and then get like go along. And your character and the player don't really necessarily think too much on that action. And that's kind of more or less what Miguel has to do here. He is taking out a guard in order to get a key. It's very, you could see the level that this would be played on, but it is so much more confronted than anything like that ever is. And it really does point out that it does not matter who it is, taking a life is taking a life. And I think that's why the moment is as disarming as it is because it takes something that would, in many other pieces of fiction, be a mundane and common occurrence, and it actually takes a lens to it and examines it, and what we see horrifies us.
Yeah. Well, as you were talking, I was doing some quick double checking. At this time in Miguel's life, he is 12 or 13 years old. To our modern sensibilities, the idea of someone that young having to kill someone else is almost unthinkable. You know, it would be hard enough for an adult that had never done violence to another person in that way, and therefore having it happen to Miguel is, you know, it naturally makes itself even more momentous than it would normally be. Mind, this isn't an idea that is new to fiction or even new century itself. I could point you at many potential sources where a young man or girl has to kill for the first time, either being taught to hunt or killing a sentient creature by accident or with intent. Miguel himself was being taught to hunt just earlier in the book, and it seems clear that in the rest of the world of New Century, young people are being conscripted to join the RSA, or needed to hunt or defend in cases like what happened at Weirwood. But even if Miguel had successfully brought down the Ibex, it would not have been the same as when he poisoned the Lion's Sailor. We certainly never got to see what it was like for Abigail, the first time she had to take a life, either Wendigo or human. The thing that I want to bring up now is that this probably puts into perspective why Miguel was not a witness to any of the sexual violence being predated upon by the sailors upon the Aboriginal cats. And the reason why I think that this was either knowingly or unknowingly the right choice is that it would not necessarily take something away from the experience, but it would make it far more muddied and complex if Miguel felt at any time like, even if he didn't know about what happened to Jorau, if he felt like he was some sort of avenging angel, specifically punishing even this nameless sailor to him for crimes that he or the other sailors committed upon the cats. That would put it more in line with the thing that one would try to avoid in terms of telling rape narratives, even if it's not Miguel's direct response to something that happens to the most important woman in his life, Rao. If he does it, I mean, if he did it as vengeance to anyone, whether it's Mohawk or the captain, or, you know, if he actually saw someone that wasn't this cat raping one of the captives down below, it would put a kind of energy behind it that would make that whole thing more muddied overall, and it would take away from the importance that as he comes away from this moment, he does not feel justified in what he did. He only feels horrified by his own capacity for violence. And that is essentially, that is very important for his character growth and his lowest point and everything like that, and characterizes some later parts in the story.
It is important that these things kind of happen because they're very personal.
Okay, yeah. We're going to make ourselves feel a little bit better here by putting some more cat buns in there. No, no, no. Keep going.
Oh my god, I didn't even like...
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh man. That one went under the radar even for me. No, No, they are actually quite personal in that, I mean, I don't want to get into the actual sort of mechanics or anything like that, but it really is something that kind of is for them to, like, process, and if you start bringing in other characters into it, it just sort of becomes even more for them to process. And for Miguel, I think the act of taking a life needs to be kind of as bare bones as that can be, if that makes sense. It has to be, like I said earlier, the function of he needs to accomplish something, and in order to do that, he needs to kill this person. It's quite a stripped-down version of the act of killing someone, because it is reducing it to its most fundamentals. You are doing this in order to ensure your own survival or to achieve your ends. And that in and of itself, even if you don't add any other like emotional motivation to that, which is kind of impossible, but for the sake of argument, let's at least try that. This sort of goes against what I was saying earlier about how with Hrau, we don't linger on the moment, whereas the point with Miguel is that
we have to.
Exactly. That's exactly it, is that we have to do that because we think that, oh, this will be a passing thing. And the point is, it doesn't pass. It stays. It's important. And I think that demonstrates an awareness of the nature of these two trauma, is that in terms of how we discuss them, is that we should not necessarily dwell on and intensify the moment of the rape occurring, but with the case of murder and taking life, it's something that shouldn't be just glanced over, because that's when if you do that, then you risk making Miguel feel sociopathic. You have to make this matter, because Miguel has been a good kid all up to this point, and it just feels like no 12-year-old should be able to do this and not feel horrible.
It's a way of differentiating, I mean, as if there wasn't enough differences between Miguel and Hrau, but being that she is a hunter and a warrior, even though she respects the weight and power of killing and only does it when she has to, she is still comfortable with it. Or at the very least, she is comfortable with...
She has come to terms.
She has come to terms with it, but she also... She has her own narrative that allows her to be able to address these things. And she can also continue to make choices that result in her only killing when she needs to. But even though, as you say, the act that Miguel takes here is purely functional, he tries to buck himself up emotionally, but it's really just in order to try and achieve a greater... a more moral goal, none of that is enough for him to protect him, to steel him against the experience of having to watch someone die and know that he's the one that caused it. That's why that's significant to him. And it works very well as a part of Alex's general thesis of not killing or not having it not have weight or seriousness whenever it comes up as being a part of the story. It just takes a different form when dealing with Miguel's experience with it as opposed to Hrau's experience with it, as opposed to the experience of other characters in the New Century oeuvre.
It is interesting to me, and I do use that properly, that by the end of Abigail's story, her first story, she has made the decision to kind of take an oath not to take life again.
This is technically a slight spoiler, as the end of Secret Rooms does not make that decision clear. The final conversation between Abigail and Annie merely has her say that due to Carl saving their lives, it's going to make her seriously weigh up the desire to use deadly force in the future just because it's easier. But it's an understandable extension of her words when the oath is revealed in the future, so I left it in to help Toby make his point.
When she didn't necessarily... I don't think she actually kills anyone within the story of Secret Rooms. She suggests it, but it doesn't actually follow through. Whereas Miguel, a child who has killed and has actually confronted it, I don't think we, you know, you can edit this out or not, but by the end of the story, he does not take that same oath. Whether he does or doesn't in the future, that time will tell. But I think a fundamental difference in character and also the environment, because I think that the point of Miguel taking on the mask of the mongoose and going on this journey in the world of Rama feels like he is going to a primal place where he is. It feels almost as if he has to confront the base nature of survival, which means at one point or another, he actually does confront killing in order to ensure his own survival. Whereas for Abigail, she's in a story where she is rejoining wider society and not just existing in a survivalist camp where they are doing everything they can, and so she actually questions how her actions can have an impact on not just her immediate surroundings but on like wider infrastructure. I think that the philosophy of Alex is something that does color a lot of New Century, but I think it is a praiseworthy attribute is that not every character comes to the same conclusions, and that's a sign of their differences in their individualities, but it's also a sign of the difference of each environment.
Yeah. No, I'm definitely with you on that. I hadn't even considered the contrast of going from survival to civilization, or the reverse of it, as being portrayed here in Tiger's Eye. Although the term civilization is way more complicated because I don't necessarily want to imply that the aborigines of Rama are savages, like, because that's the language that the Lions of Albion would use, and it takes the impassioned
that they are uncivilized.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They are little more than animals, and so therefore the lion's subjugation of them, that's what justifies them looking upon them as property, right up until Quincy Matthews makes the argument that no, if you actually chose to look closely at them, you'd see for yourself that these are not base beasts, that they are in fact people, and you're just ignoring that because it serves your purposes.
Yes, and then one of the captive cats comes forward with glasses and says, "Civilization."
Okay. Yes, I needed the brainy gremlin was going on in the back of my head as well.
That was a quick draw moment where I was thinking, Greg's going to make that reference. I'll wait for my opportunity, and then one of us is going to make that reference.
I'm sorry, I need to do the spaghetti western whistle there, because that's...
Exactly.
Draw.
Mimic.
Well played, sir. Well played. I bow to your superior timing.
Comedy is all about
timing.
No. Timing.
At this point, we had already been talking for over 2 hours, even though some of that was pre-podcast socialization, and we were getting punchy after some of the trying earlier subject material. Given that we had a lot more to discuss and I had a floor on how much longer we could talk, we decided to stop for the day and pick back up later. Unfortunately, this meant that I screwed up and forgot that we hadn't covered one of the questions on my list, and didn't find this out until the edit. But since it was regarding the characterization of Captain Queensberry, and I know we give her plenty of time both during this section and the next, I'll just fast-forward us to the next topic.
Aside from all the discussion that we had of the traumatic event in Chapter 16, this moment where Miguel walks into the hold wearing the mask and he sees Hrau and realizes that she is there and has likely been suffering along with all of the other cats, and Hrau sees him, both chagrined in her own way and yet happy to see that he is both there and that he has obtained something that will actually give them a fighting chance. But she realizes that given his current appearance, he is spooking the other cats, and so therefore not only has to do something in order to make the rest of them feel better, but also ends up admitting what has been in her heart this entire time when she lets all of the other cats know, this is my son. It's
oh, my heart.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hugely emotional moment, and it's a final, like, there is still drama and conflict to come, particularly since, you know, in the moments immediately after this, the fight to take over the whale begins. But this moment feels like we're exhaling a breath that we've been holding perhaps ever since the fight in the old city. And it just sort of, like, even though we don't necessarily know what's going to happen from here, we take in some of that same comfort that Hrau refers to when she embraces Miguel and names him as her son.
It carries this, it is a defining moment of the story, and I think that the significance of it is not just the implications of Miguel meaning this much to her. It also, we can't, it means that we can't help but think about Carol and her other child, because I think that this might not be something that makes sense on a sort of practical level, but nevertheless, it emotionally is what this scene represents to me, is that for so long, Hrau has not allowed herself to think of her child. She has not allowed herself to think of or to accept that part of her past, because it just, it carries too much. And I don't know if it's accurate to say that she hasn't allowed to herself to think of herself as a mother, because I don't think I can make that judgment. But predominantly she has been a hunter, or she has been an escort to Miguel to get him back home. And by accepting what Miguel has come to mean to her, it is simultaneously an acceptance of him, but I think it's also an acceptance of Carol and what her past with that was. It's not necessary that that has all healed, but I think she's finally able to define herself as a mother again. And I don't think she's defining herself as a mother for just Miguel in this moment.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned in your notes here is the book emphasizing the importance of family as the tribe makes it a part of her life. Throughout all of the events thus far, where she is pushing herself to provide for her family in the way that she is comfortable with, but also in the way that she needs her family, needs companionship, whether it's Durga tribe or craving the contact of either for a while traveling with the Panthers, or the Trader Panthers specifically, or taking some time spent in Yamaya Village with that group of cats. It's, I guess, perhaps partly reflective of what she has lost. It isn't just that she needs her family. This open wound that we're talking about here, the loss of Carol, something about her having a child of her own seemed to matter to her in a way that was more important than anything else. And even though perhaps doing things for Durga tribe was not enough for her because she continued to be functional rather than heal over, not having it at all was even more perhaps regularly stressful on her, even as she was continuing to act as if Miguel was a new cub for her to teach and take care of.
And most importantly, interacting with Miguel brought her out of stasis and made her care about something again. Not just in the abstract, but in a concrete way. Even as his presence caused chaos in some parts of her life, he awoke something in her long dormant.
A further expression of that desire for family and working together could be implicit in the way that she took it upon herself to make these collection of disparate cats, prisoners in the hold, into a new family in and of itself.
Yes.
You know, one tribe. Yeah, exactly. In point of fact, some of that symbolism is referenced later on when Crow is having a conversation with Chief Shala, and he is asking her questions about Miguel and, you know, about what she plans to do with him for him. And she's like, I need to send him back to his home. He has this bit of wisdom where he has to express himself very simply because they are still learning how to communicate with each other, but suggesting that what they had created together, this new tribe, could be a new accepting home for Miguel. Like, he was willing to take it that far.
Yes, and because it's expressed simply, and primarily that's due to necessity of their developing communication with one another, but nevertheless it has the effect of a simple truth feeling that much more wise, because it's not complicated. It doesn't have to be made any more complex than that one central truth, showing that that has been accepted by cats beyond just Frau and her people who know her or who have known her before. It, I think, shows just how much these cats on the boat have experienced things that they never could have imagined, that her accepting this alien creature perhaps seems less unusual than it would have before all this.
Yeah, we'll talk about this a little bit more when we dive in deep to the individual stories of the cats as relayed in the chapter Tales of the Stalwart Whale. But one has to consider the possibility, like, Durga tribe did not support Hrau at all when she was making the argument for keeping Miguel alive back when all of this was going on. And yet, thanks to the circumstances that have led everybody here, obviously his role in helping to free them as well, and her, also her saying, "This is my son, this is my cub," likely had some influence in the decisions that everybody made. It also, when we talk about the response to trauma, how Hrau embraces Miguel to give comfort, but also get back some for herself, it could be that there was a similar effect to that for all of the cats witnessing it.
They had been through so much alone and together, suffering without respite, their wills being worn away. Hrau's public humiliation was a symbol of their suffering. But while Hrau might have brought them together, up until that moment it was from a shared desire to not go quietly into that good night. Determination to face their opponents, even if it means losing their lives. Now Hrau's position of being a symbol to them takes on a different form. She goes to this creature they fear, not only accepting him in front of all, but showing an act of tenderness and love. Something that could have been a healing moment that also affected them all. There is an aphorism that sadness shared is sadness halved. Imagine if that was also true for Joy. If those gathered saw this intimacy, and it kindled hope inside them, even before it is revealed that he has the tools for their survival.
Does any of that make sense?
That makes it. It's not just that that makes sense, that makes perfect sense to me. I think that it would be just as valid, I think, if it was something she said to Miguel in private, but it's a declaration. That's the point of it. It's not just an internal realization that she is voicing to the audience as a narrator. It's an actual declaration. She's had to be open to them, not just because one of the most lowest moments of her life was forcibly displayed to all of them. It's because she has chosen of her own volition to forge connections with them. And this is her choice. She has the ability to choose to be open about this part of her. And so that's, I think, why the declaration has as much power as it does, both within the story for the characters present and for the audience, for the readers and listeners who have been with Hrau all this time and know full well that she has never made this declaration before. She has never had this thought before. She is coming to this realization, like sharing that thought, her connection with Miguel, just as it has dawned on her, I think makes it, it just cements it as the defining moments of not just this book, but of New Century to me, because it is about this connection between people who are literally worlds apart, and not only a sincere celebration of that fact, but using that as a means of forging new connections, of propelling it forward. That will be relevant to future books, this particular relationship and connection that Hrau and Miguel share, being cited as this reason for why there is hope for more connections to be made. And that's why I think that Tiger's Eye maybe stands out for readers, listeners, us, and even the people involved in New Century, Alex especially. Why this story means so much is because it is this benchmark for what New Century is and what New Century wants to celebrate and generate.
Yeah. I don't know that much more can be said about it, except as you were talking, it feels like there is a clear dichotomy taking place that, like, we had this long conversation about whether Hrau's rape needed to actually be a part of the book, and all of that conversation was still valid, mm-hmm. but if we look at it through the lens of these diametrically opposing moments, it almost makes too much sense, because in the scene before, she was forced to be vulnerable non-consensually.
Mm-hmm.
In this moment, she is making a choice to be vulnerable in front of all of these others as well.
And that means everything.
Yeah, that's literally her responding act of defiance, showing that she will not let the violation... It isn't just that she helps forge all the other cats into a new tribe. That's a part of it. But that's also a violent counter-response. That is a, we are not going to be victims anymore, but that's not the same as being willing to be vulnerable in front of people that she wants to trust her, and having that be her choice.
Put another way, Mohawk took her agency, and this is the first concrete step of fucking taking it back. She will not let his actions define her.
And it's not about, like, the guiding principle is not about hatred and a desire for retribution against the lions. So much of the conversation is about what they want for themselves, not what they want to inflict on others, because that is what the lions have done to them, is inflicting upon others. And to me, it makes so much sense that it's important that you decide to choose what you want to do for yourselves and what you control about your own actions, not fixate on chasing retribution against those who are trying to take control away from you. It's even that statement feels like it doesn't quite articulate it well enough, but this movement has more of a sort of hopeful light to it than it is a violent scrap in chasing something ugly. It is chasing something essential and beautiful, which is the connections forged between each other, not the mutual hatred of their enemy.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that more in a second, then, when we actually get to that moment, because it also dovetails with the personal story and experience with Glam. So we come from this very emotional, personal moment into the big fight, which takes up a good portion of one chapter and a section of another, as the action-packed proceedings go from retaking the ship to strategically choosing to keep some of them alive, including the doctor and the captain, and then realizing that the one thing that sort of spurred them all to action to begin with is this Leviathan from the sea, the widow beneath the waves, is continuing to potentially pose a threat to everyone aboard. So even as they have success over their immediate opponents, the slaving sailors, they still have to somehow ensure that the Leviathan, that the widow, doesn't kill them all either. And it's another one of those moments where this is some of the epic cat battles that we're here for, just like the confrontation between Hrau and the many animals that were taken over by Haka's mind powers, or the fight between the two of them in the old city. But
the further we go into this, the more I'm realizing that Tiger's Eye would be so expensive to adapt into a film.
Well, if we were going with pure CGI, that's true. It would be very Warcraft movie-esque in terms of what would be required. I think back when they were discussing, it was during one of the roundtables, and I don't think it was Tiger's Eye because I haven't listened to most of that. I think it was during the Steamheart roundtable. Someone had asked, I think, about what medium they would use if they adapted various parts of New Century into a visual medium. And one of the things that they discussed was that Tiger's Eye might work best in some animated format rather than trying to do any form of live action or quote-unquote live action, since if you're doing anthropomorphic tigers, then you're going to have to use some form of, like, there aren't going to be people walking around in cat suits.
Especially not after how Cats the Musical ended up.
You know, it would be something more along the lines of the mocap that they did in order to accomplish the recent Apes movies and everything like that. And that would be hugely expensive, right?
I mean, I thought that has crossed my mind, and it would be a very sort of odd, surreal thing, but if you did Tiger's Eye as this purely 2D animation with painstaking, like, attention to detail, you know, I don't ask much. and including Miguel being drawn in 2D animation.
Are you thinking about, like, Samurai Jack then or something like that? Like,
yeah, along that lines. Yeah, or just the, oh, I forget the name of the company that do such good job with films that I haven't seen yet, I'm sorry, including the Bread Girl, the Breadwinner, I forget, and Song of the Sea, and they've done something recently.
You're talking about Cartoon Saloon.
That's it. Those people there are amazing, and I can say that even without having seen a film, because I can just take a look at a single clip of animation and go, yeah, no, these people are some of the best in the industry.
We went on about this for a while, discussing the different ways New Century could come to life on the big screen and small screen. It's something that Alex has discussed before with his actors during roundtables, and it's even entirely possible that one could mix and match styles, and that would work just fine. But the more I listened to us go on, our conclusions didn't seem that exciting. Neither of us know that much about film or animation production, so it was speculation that led to a lot of I don't know answers. At the end of the day, I just decided to trim out this entire digression so that we could get back to subjects we could speak intelligently on.
Okay, the battle. Getting back to the battle.
The battle. That's the thing that we were talking about. And the...
Yeah. The scale of these two battles is definitely noteworthy, because the battle with the lions is rather fast and frantic and bloody, but it is over relatively quickly, and I think that shows a restraint that I find commendable. These lions are slavers, and among them rapists, so it is beyond natural to want to see them suffer, but the freed cats actually focus on doing what needs to be done to secure victory, not on doling out revenge and extending the suffering of their captors.
Like they, you were saying a moment ago, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, precisely. And it's even brought up, we need to leave at least this many alive. And it's like, wait, what? Why? And then they realize, oh yeah, we need this. There is an eye on efficiency, not on the idea of we need to punish these cats.
Yeah, it's a balance, survival.
Exactly. It's a balance between retribution against the unjust and striving to be better than those who perpetrate the wrongs of this world. By contrast, the fight with the widow has a lot more detail, and I feel a lot more time dedicated to her, and I think it's because of the respect and awe surrounding this creature. It's part of nature and warrants that respect. And the narration works to impart that to the reader with all the like detail and scope and scale of its nature and existence could ascribe to it. The battle with it is suitably grand and exciting, but again, our protagonists don't inflict any more harm than necessary because this creature belongs here and should stay alive. Hrau is very aware that they are encroaching on her ground. Besides, even if the cats did want to kill it, it seems like this creature is slightly above what this party of warrior cats is capable of bringing down.
Yeah. As things play out, it seems like they successfully convince the widow that whatever caused her to be upset, we don't necessarily know what at this point, why she attacked the boat to begin with. It could be territory or it could have been something else. It's one of those things that's going through Hrau's mind as they manage to basically just convince the widow to leave, like the cost of being wounded is not worth whatever elemental goals it might have. And she goes on to think, like, you know, the fight against the lions was necessary from multiple levels, but much like any interaction that Crow or potentially other hunters have with the wildlife of the world, they don't necessarily want to kill unless they have to. To a certain extent, it's not just that they have a natural respect for the creatures in the world. They also can understand that, like at one point, Crow refers to the widow as a goddess, as being something momentous and powerful, and something that you should not want to try to kill, because she is not just a creature of the world. She is perhaps, one could say, akin to the way certain Native American tribes considered the Thunderbird, as being a force of nature, as being a representation and voice of the natural world itself. On top of that, the widow's presence was a distraction and provided the potential that they needed in order to succeed over the lions. And so one could even say that the cat should be thankful of her presence, but they can't simply say, good job, thanks for helping us out, you can go back to being a thing under the sea now, because they can't actually communicate with the widow. So they have to fight with her just in order to protect their own lives.
It is indiscriminate, and it just knows that this ship should not be here, or it pushes against this ship. But having said that, there was a thought that occurred to me, and I don't necessarily believe this is the case, but it is nevertheless an intriguing possibility in terms of its implications. Is what this moment feels like is that the widow beneath the waves is Rama itself pushing back against this unnatural exercise that the lions are perpetuating, this slavery, and everything about this is almost like the world itself is pushing out against it. And then I realized there is actually precedent in this story for the natural inhabitants or the creatures of Rama being utilized for an expressed purpose. And I wonder if there is another shaman out there that has the knowledge and power, the ability to actually influence even just somewhat the direction of the widow.
That's something we're probably going to have to chew on a little bit, because we can only work within the text provided.
Yes.
Based on the information that we have thus far, when Haka was using his abilities, and this may be abilities that other shamans share, Like, we don't necessarily know how these teachings came about and whether it's purely a tiger tradition, like maybe there are other traditions with other tribes. But let's suppose that if one shaman could do it, then other shamans could have some further ability into this regard. We don't yet know the depths of what kind of power the shaman can bring. Like, we've only seen Haka's abilities, and those were all relatively close. Like, he was able to influence animals that were not too far away from him, and he could potentially ride in them some distance in order to achieve, because we don't actually know how close he was to Miguel and Hrau during that whole chase sequence. But it may simply be that he can take over the mind of an animal that's relatively close to him, and then as long as he continues to be in their mind, he can ride it out further. But it might be more difficult, say, for him to reach out and touch the mind of something that is, there is far too much distance between them, in or not. So, yeah, we don't know the mechanics of how all of that works.
Yeah. It's definitely a reach, but it was nevertheless one that I thought, oh, that might be worth putting down to paper or MP3.
Exactly. We don't necessarily know that, say, the Silent One is more powerful than Haka. In point of fact, the level of power that is ascribed to Haka overall, in terms of both his martial ability and in terms of now we've seen that he is capable of taking over the minds of several animals at once. This conversation got a little complicated and punchy because we were trying to discuss the idea of how powerful a shaman was versus something like the Widow, when future chapters specifically give insight into this, and we can't discuss it without spoiling new readers. So once more, we will skip ahead. Having reviewed what we have left to discuss, however, namely the aftermath of the battle and the final chapter we intended to cover during this arc, I think we will leave it there for the week. That leaves our episode a little short, but if I try to make the edit longer, I may not get a better stopping point. And thanks to current events, I'm already running late on getting this episode turned around. So that the next retrospective episode doesn't get top-heavy, I'm going to put the outtakes after the song for this week, and next week we will just end normally on whatever musical choice I make to play us out. Everyone that listens to us regularly, I'm feeling as raw and ragged as you are. I was very excited when the newest New Century dropped, namely Stone Spring Maidens. I was up late reading it that very night, closing out with the seeming good news of the Georgia Senate runoffs. And then the very next day, things went to shit. And even now, we are still trying to come back from that, feeling uncertain and angry and scared. I hope that you are able to enjoy this episode, even though it deals with heavy topics. And though I wanted to wait until after we finished our retrospective, I may end up interrupting it for next week in order to give us something a little more lighthearted, namely our interview with Spencer Lieb, who ended up being a thorough joy. But playing us out is a track I had been saving for a future intro, because I couldn't decide on something from my usual playlist that would work both for the current state of affairs and the topics at hand. This is a beautiful instrumental piece I found a long while back on freemusicarchive.org by Scott Holmes. Until next time, this is Together We Stand.
The preface to this outtake is that I was asking Toby about his plans with Sarah for Thanksgiving, completely having a brain fart that Thanksgiving really isn't a thing for anybody across the pond. It's really more of a U.S. or alternately Canada thing.
No, we will just be doing the same thing we do every night, Pinky, trying to take over the world.
Well, hurry up, for God's sake. We need a steadier hand on the wheel than what we currently got. If I'd known you were doing that all the time, I would have been saying, oh, no, take as much time as you need. We'll record in a couple of months.
Yeah, no, we'll get the world together, invest in wind or technology, and then just be able to pull in Greg's and Toby's from multiple dimensions and say, yeah, so how's New Century in your world?
Because that's the only thing we care about. No, that's not.
No. Yeah, like we create this dimension hopping technology only to talk about a book series that's pretty neat.
Yeah, we went off on a bit of a tangent on alternate realities at this point, which makes perfect sense since New Century is a multiverse. This led into a discussion of Doctor Who.
Those couple of episodes in the Russell T. Davies span of Doctor Who episodes when they go to a parallel Earth, and it's where that particular run of the show's version of the Spider... I would almost said the Spider-Man instead of the Cybermen.
Oh, okay. I think I know what you're talking about now. Yeah, exactly. The Spider-Man. Yeah. The Earth has been taken over by the Spider-Men.
J. Jonah Jameson was right.
God damn it, I told you to get me pictures. I would have more things to say about how Miles Morales handles the cops in this one, but we've been talking for a half hour now about not time.
Welcome to the Through the Window Miles Morales episode. It's an odd spin-off, but here we go.
At one point during our first Skype session, I had to take off my headset in order to deal with a little bit of noise pollution. And Toby left a little gift for me on the recording to find later.
Hello, future Greg. If you can hear this, you're doing a great job.
And because I had done something similar a few weeks back, this was my response on getting back to the mic.
All right, what'd you say behind my back?
I said nothing except something for future Greg to enjoy in the edit.
Oh, okay, great. Well, okay, at least I appreciate that I have a present coming my way.
As I said before, I think I can do most days. I might be able to do Hush, Wendigos, they've somehow hijacked a police car.
Oh no, they're evolving.
That's gonna be a brainy Wendigo.
To those not aware, Apple is the name of Toby's new pet hamster.
Oh, hello. Sorry, I'm being distracted, Greg, because Sarah's just brought in Apple and he's adorable. Hello.
Hello, tiny creature.
Greg says hello, tiny creature. He says hello back.
I think he says squeak, but I understand if you're trying to translate for it.
Look, we've been talking about Tiger's Eye. We do a lot of interpreting and communication. It works.
Oh yeah, here was me specifically asking him about the Folger's crystals crack from a few episodes ago.
How did you enjoy the end of the episode that we just reviewed, and you got to hear what I was saying? You got up for some reason.
You bastard. I've put a pH solution into my water now. It's coming out neutral. I'm keeping an eye on it, and I'm keeping an eye on you.
This was in response to a conversation that got cut out of the edit and was referencing our inability to stay on the listed topics sometimes.
we have a planned thing, and, you know, we try and stick to it, but new and interesting shiny things come up, and we reach up our paws and we bat at it. We bat at it like it's a cat toy.
Oh, yeah, no, like, whenever a laser pointer crosses our line of sight, we have to chase it. Yeah, I'm now, like, concocting this sort of Ocean-style, like, heist plan, which is just to trick Hollywood to create, like, a new century series. And then when it inevitably gets traction, it's like, ha-ha! Like, in the same way that the Deadpool test footage totally leaked out. It was not like, oh, we don't know who leaked it out. Oh, but look at how many people enjoy it. Like, just get some, like, test footage for New Century, put it out there and be like, oh, it's, ooh, how did this happen?
Coming up, the documentary Shaw's 11, about how a bunch of creators and fans deign to try and sneak a stealth hit into the eyes of Hollywood in order to get their beloved creation made.
You didn't hear it here first, because we're keeping this all secret until the heist is complete.
Yeah, exactly. Suckers. And then we're going to film the fucking documentary.
Oh, yeah. What, like, will I interview you and you interview me?
Yeah, well, we have to find the other members of the crew that will help us make this happen. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a tangent and a half, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun right there. We appreciated that.